This is the Greenian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greenian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma and the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Greenian Bunker, my friends, you know exactly what time it is. I'm hoping the guys in the studio here with me know what time it is, because we're about to start the show. The show that you tune into every week. You know what? The microphones aren't even on yet, because apparently, there's been a conversation going on in here in studio that's been so nasty. These guys have been going at it so hard, we're going to have to take this to the airwaves here for just a moment. But first, my friends, you've tuned into that dark little corner of the web known only as the Greenian Report. And I, of course, am your happy host, Mr. Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South. Welcome to another week of wonder and weirdness. Joining me in studio, the men with plans, plan number 11 from Zeta 2 Reticuli, probably, Mr. Chris Hayes, producer, co-host, and all-around great guy. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing well, Micah. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. You know, you're still a little red in the face, though, man. Your skin is almost as red as your hair, all right? Being the fiery redhead that you are. And, boy, you're getting fired up over there. Matt Oakley, our engineer who's joining us here, pushing all the right buttons, as always, behind the master console at Greenian International Headquarters. I think you're still catching your breath. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing fine. I just wanted to let you know that you were talking about plans. Chris doesn't have a plan. There's no rhyme or reason.
Okay, now hold on.
I personally have a plan, Matt. And on a long enough timeline, you can go to hell.
There is a slight disparity in terms of the characters in this program. And what that is I think that I talk too much. Okay, everybody who does fan art draws pictures of Chris. And Matt gets everything else, okay? He gets paid. He gets free copies of, advanced copies of new books, like this new book I'm holding here that I have written that Matt gets a copy of. That's right. We're going to be talking more about that later tonight.
Oh, where's my copy?
Oh, you get one, too.
What? No.
I just gave him one first.
You know, and on a long enough timeline, that's really not a good move. That's not a nice thing to do.
He's just sore because I have a point.
You guys have been wrestling,
Matt,
or something?
He is.
Matt, you're employing classic apologist debate tactics, and there's no point in arguing with it because...
No, I'm just making fun of you.
It's circular logic.
Okay, now look, now hold on. Now, I'm going to be the moderator here of this debate, but I'm going to just give you guys the entire first segment before we get to any real news, because this was just so heated, so intense, that you guys... Now, you already were firing off at him. Now, you got to keep in mind, we are on public airwaves, Mr. Producer. So you got to keep it... That was kosher. That wasn't obscene. We just don't normally talk like that hundreds of miles, maybe several hundreds of thousands of miles beneath Earth's surface, okay?
I would really prefer not to carry this debate on air.
No,
because
it's of
a deeply personal nature to me.
All I really want to ask is what precisely... I was busy... answering emails. I was getting emails from people, literally. As a matter of fact, something we're going to be touching on here in just a few minutes. I've gotten this message. One of our field correspondents sent me a text message saying, world leaders are about to announce that we are not alone after the discovery of a 5,000-year-old Vimana in a cave in Afghanistan. Now, this was apparently broken on Coast to Coast AM. We've got a story. We're going to be talking about this a little bit later. I know Chris is just crying over there. I kid you not, at the last minute, I thought, who better to get than Philip Coppens on the program to talk about that? And unfortunately, we couldn't reach him in, like, the hour that we had prior to taking the airwaves tonight. Phil would be the perfect guy to talk about this, so we're going to have to give it our best shot, although I think some of our listeners say that, this is true. I've been told that the very best debate that they've ever heard about Vimanas actually took place on this program between yours truly, the Mouth of the South, and Philip Coppens. And we don't really disagree. It was just a good discussion about what really is a Vimana. If you've never heard of one, you're about to be educated, as you often are when you listen to this program. But speaking about education, we've got two very educated gentlemen here in the studio. Matt Oakley here is a politically active young man. As a matter of fact, I hear you're going to be writing some editorials here in this region after your recent political activity that's been getting you a lot of attention.
Yeah, that's right.
The anti-unionist, Mr. Matt the Reverend Oakley.
Not completely, just in certain circumstances, I feel it's a pretty poor choice.
Okay, exactly. Now unfortunately, that's not what we're going to be discussing tonight. I'm about to ask you guys precisely what we're going to be discussing, but of course, you know, a theology major as well as a anthropology...
not theology. Religion.
Not religion. Religious studies. I apologize. Okay, I apologize. I'm now, who's being apologetic now? Okay, so it's religious studies and anthropology. double major that you hold from Appalachian State University. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now you guys were really getting into it. This literally was taking place up until the minute that Matt cued the microphones tonight. And mysteries of space-time, and really, truthfully, something that we discussed with Giorgio Tsoukalos last week on the program, the mysteries of human origins seem to play into this. These are really all the big questions about life as we know it anyway. And so I'm going to ask Matt, because, again, I think Chris is still a little too angry. We got to give him just a minute. He's going to unleash all of hell's fury here in just a moment, I can tell. Matt, what were you guys debating here up until literally seconds before we took the airwaves tonight?
I had brought up the idea. Initially, we were listening to religious radio in the car.
Okay.
Which, you know, we were both kind of getting a kick out of.
Okay.
And I said, you know, I really don't buy what this guy on the radio is saying. However, I also don't buy that being here is complete nothingness, that, you know, we're here for absolutely no reason other than, you know, humankind and the earth just came into being.
So in other words, you're making the argument that there is some sort of a creator, some sort of an intelligence behind what we know as existence. Would that in general terms frame the discussion?
My whole point is I don't know, and the discussion was more about how I say it is just as irresponsible to say that there is absolutely 100% no God as it is to say there is absolutely 100% a God.
Okay, now
both
Chris,
sides are being irresponsible.
Now Chris, okay, now I'm assuming taking an opposite stance from Matt's argument, where do you differ with his opinion on this? At very least the phrasing of the question that you guys were debating, where do you differ from Matt's opinion on this?
Well, first and foremost, Matt's under the assumption that I'm 100% sure about the fact that there is no creator.
You said that.
Or creationism thing.
See how silly you guys are if I jump in here? Okay, go ahead.
Some conscious catalyst to the universe's existence. And you're right, Matt. Being 100% sure of anything is intellectually irresponsible. I have never said I'm 100% sure that there is no creator. I have said I don't believe in it until it comes and talks to me personally. That allows room for error, a very tiny, teeny, tiny margin of error, but it allows for it.
But you're still going to, at the very least, lean more to one side than the other.
Well, of course, yes.
Exactly.
There are sides, and sides are taken.
I'm saying that sitting on either one of those sides to the extreme is irresponsible. Scientifically, philosophically, spiritually,
I got to say real quick, even though I'm known for being the mouth of the South, and according to last week's discourse, the guy who likes to say his own name an awful lot, there has to be a creator, okay? And the evidence I provide for that is quite, you know, apparent here in the studio with us. I'm letting you guys talk during the first segment, so I mean,
again, that's experiential evidence, and that is the weakest form of evidence there is.
So he's still debating. Okay, I like where you're going with that, though. All right, continue, please. Don't let me interrupt you guys. I'm good at that. Okay, you got to watch me.
Okay, well, my whole point of view, my whole stance is, until proven otherwise, proof, not, hey, let's go talk about it, proof, and not from a book, whichever book, I'm including all books.
Whether that be a holy script or a textbook, I imagine, right?
Well, a holy script, yes.
Or a textbook.
Or a textbook.
Well, a book written by people who have devoted their entire lives to repeatable... what's the word?
Repeatable experimental evidence, maybe?
Repeatable testable results.
So textbooks.
I haven't read a textbook since 2007.
So
first
textbooks.
And foremost, I listen to individuals.
But
yes.
Well, I would say this though,
and the scientific community as a whole, for the most part.
Now I see where you're going with that. But now here's the whole thing. I would argue that the fallibility of the human senses. You remember when our good friend Stephen Hawking, good friend of the program, physicist Stephen Hawking, who says that all UFO believers are cranks and weirdos. Okay, and that if UFOs were anything valid, any kind of a valid, observable, repeatable scientific phenomenon that had not been classified by the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, and other official organizations worldwide, In all his brilliance, in all his knowing and mental prowess, Mr. Hawking, of course, made this astute and brilliant observation that all people who believe in or claim they have seen or had interactions with what we would term as an unidentified flying object, they're all cranks and weirdos, okay? Despite that...
And I've come out against that, by the way.
Well, of course. What I'm getting at here is that that, of course, is a very subjective opinion. The senses, the same man, by the way, Hawking, said that philosophy is dead. No, it's not.
No.
That is the most arrogant and silly thing that a science, okay, minded individual could possibly say. And the reason why is because you cannot take for granted the potential fallibility of the human senses. Whether that be a person who perceives something of a religious or spiritual nature, or someone who is observing the sciences. Because I'm sorry, there are limitations, no doubt, to human perception. And even our best scientific instrumentation is going to be limited, okay, in terms of what is observable still through human perception. We may have instrumentation, but we're still observing it through eyes, ears, noses, okay? Sense of touch, sense of pressure.
And to that,
extrasensory perception.
I like to add on to that because people seem to forget this one really, really important word, yet. Yet. We are limited right now by the technology we have. Our science is being driven by technology right now. It's a cycle. At certain points, science is driven by technology. At other points, technology is driven by science. Right now, we're in a technology-driven scientific period. And once the technology is advanced enough to match the science, then we will know far more than we do now.
But we can't go off the future, though. There's no future.
On a long enough timeline, you can.
There's no future.
That seems to be your big argument.
No.
On a long enough timeline.
I'm working on the past.
That's
You're working on the future right now, and future, no, doesn't work, doesn't factor in, because there is no future. It's not real, all right? It hasn't happened yet, so
well, the future hasn't
there.
Happened, and therefore
exactly.
we really
you can't guarantee that it's going to happen.
And we can't base, boy, I tell you, with the threat of things like electromagnetic pulse or Hadal uprisings, I mean, who knows what the future holds, if there'll even be a future. Okay, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but that's beyond the scope of the present argument. Now, the point is, again, that I'm trying to drive home, will we ever get to a point where we know everything? See, I argue that we won't. And frankly, if we ever knew anything, well, then wouldn't we match the criteria for being what we conceptualize as humans as being a god? You know, an all-knowing, omnipotent being. I don't think personally that we as humans, at least the humans of today, will ever reach that point, okay? I don't know that any sentient intelligence could ever reach that point, but that's really framed entirely by that fundamental opening statement, I don't know. So, again, is a science textbook really any more, I don't know, beneficial in terms of coming to a fuller understanding of the universe than, you know, a holy script? Is
yes.
it really?
Yes.
You would
yes,
argue
it
that it is.
I do, in fact, argue that it is.
Even taking into consideration the fallibility of the human senses?
Yes.
Okay, and how so?
Because the things we have from textbooks, the things we have learned in science, the things the advances we've made are all based on, again, repeatable, testable evidence. Things that we perform test A over and over and over and over and over and over again to the nth degree and get the same result every time. I put way more credence in that than some guy wrote a book.
Now, I agree with you, but I'm playing devil's advocate here. Now, let me just bring up one more thing, Matt, before I bring you back into the debate. The great debate occurring in the Moho. There's a rumbling down in the Hollow Earth tonight. Let me just tell you. Now, Chris, before we took the airwaves, you brought to the table something like gravity, okay? And you brought that into the equation, saying that, okay, we have science that proves without a doubt that gravity exists. Now, I agree with you, but I still think that there's not a lot of debate about this. Again, this is kind of a fringe belief, but there have been scientific papers and people in various modes of interpretation and thought pertaining to the mysteries of space-time that have asked whether gravity is, first of all, if gravity is really what it appears to be as observed by humans, it appears to be an attractant force that objects exert on one another. But there are questions such as, well, is it really something that an object exerts on other objects and, you know, larger objects, you know, with greater mass and density actually attract smaller objects of lesser mass and density toward them? Or is there some sort of a secondary force that is pushing? Think of it along these lines. Imagine if you had a marble and you drop a marble into a glass of water and the water allows the marble to come into the water and sink to the bottom. The marble doesn't float on the surface. It passes through and it sinks to the bottom, but the water closes around it and exerts pressure on all sides of the marble as it surrounds it. Something along those lines. Is there some sort of a force that is exerting pressure from outside, which is what we observe as an attractant force? You see, I think that even those things that we know to exist, there are still questions about those things. So again, my question, not to be entirely too ambiguous here, but what do we really know? Because we don't have all the answers. We don't have all the information to be able to base all of our judgments. And you're right. I think that, yes, textbooks do provide repeatable scientific data. And
I'm sorry. And Matt was getting upset with my semantics games, but I feel like in a conversation like this, semantics are incredibly, incredibly, deathly important.
Well, sure they
don't know where you keep getting the word textbook from. I have never mentioned a textbook.
I did.
In this whole argument.
Yeah, I brought that up, actually.
Yeah, but it doesn't figure into the argument. I'm arguing people and not textbooks.
Okay, well, maybe I was mistaken. I asked you, juxtaposing, I guess, a Bible, for instance, versus a college textbook. But I was using that as a frame of reference more than anything. So anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted again.
College textbooks are...
They're obviously no good. Look how you turned out, right?
It's not that they're no good. It's that once you have one edition of it, that's all you get until the next edition is printed. Science happens on every second of the day. We advance literally every second of the day, and something as permanent as a book can't keep up with it. So you've got to pay attention to the people involved in the activity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Matt, I'm sorry, you were itching. Go ahead.
I just have to get back to the point. Chris keeps making fun of it, but my whole idea revolves around the fact that if you work on a long enough timeline, and Chris says, well, you know, creationist theory has nothing really factual to go off of, that's fine. I'll give you that 100%. But your science also only goes back so far. Well, it happened at the Big Bang. That's where the universe came about. Well, where did those particles come from that made the Big Bang happen? Well, we haven't gotten there yet. So, therefore, I keep saying, on a long enough timeline, your science is just as flawed
so Matt,
as the belief in a, you know, supreme being.
Okay, so you find a dead body. In this dead body is a bullet hole. You know they've been shot, but where's the bullet?
You're working on right then and there. I'm saying far enough back.
It can be scaled down. This can be scaled down.
No, the bullet was somewhere, but then someone had to shoot the gun. Yeah, but where did they get the gun? Well, yeah, well, who made the gun? Well, yeah, what was the guy's name who made the... See, you go far enough back, everything's going to get convoluted and everything's going to get messed up, and you can't trace it back that far. Even in that simple circumstance, and over the course of billions and trillions of years, I'm sorry, your science can't take it back that far.
Okay, I have to say
yet.
That... yet, exactly. And just
yet.
Imagine, though, what if we could trace science back several more hundred years than we have the ability to right now? What if we could time travel back 5,000 years ago? Would we see aircraft flying around in Earth's atmosphere? You know, I've always been a bit skeptical about that myself. But then again, and guys, we'll have to pick up this debate again some other time because we've got to talk about the potential existence of a spaceship, a 5,000-year-old spaceship in a cave in Afghanistan when we come back here on the Graylian Report.
If you've ever wondered about the mysteries of our universe and of our ancient past, this is the event for you, the Paradigm Symposium 2012. The Paradigm Symposium will feature unique presentations, a banquet dinner, and guest lectures by me and names like Eric von Däniken.
My name is Eric von Däniken. I'm the author of Chariots of the Gods and 32 other books about extraterrestrials. I am happy, after some 15 years, to come back to the United States this fall to the symposium.
Giorgio Tsoukalos.
Hey, it's Giorgio Tsoukalos from Ancient Aliens, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at the Paradigm Symposium this October.
Tickets are selling fast, so reserve yours today. Visit ParadigmSymposium.com. That's ParadigmSymposium.com. The Paradigm Symposium 2012. brought to you by Intrepid Magazine and The Graylian Report.
Welcome back to the program, asking all the most important questions about life. How, where, when, and of course, most importantly, why. This is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South, joined in studio, as always, by Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley. Do you know what a Vimana is? You know, Matt, I know that you know what a Vimana is, but you also had to have a reminder before. Now, you
did.
You claimed that you just couldn't hear really what I was saying. I can tend to speak kind of quickly sometimes.
Well, and in a bar setting, it's a bit difficult sometimes. Especially when Iggy Pop is playing in the background.
That's right. Well, they had Wi-Fi, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and people kept walking by wanting to know why we had copies of Real Monsters, Gruesome Critters, and Beasts from the Dark Side by Brad Steiger lying out on the table. You know, I heard that Brad Steiger was on our friends at the Paracast's radio program recently. I always like to try and stop and take a few minutes to hear Brad when he does an appearance on radio programs. And months and months ago, I'd asked Brad, we need to line up an interview with you on the Graylian Report. I hadn't actually spoken to Brad since, of all things, actually, he had me join him as a guest on Jeff Rentz's radio program one night. Yeah, that's the last time I spoke to Brad, so he wasn't actually a guest on my show. He had me come and be a guest with him on somebody else's radio show. And so I said, Brad, we've got to line up a time that we can talk. And he said, well, how about our mutual favorite month, October? And unfortunately, I've been so busy, I haven't gotten back with him. So hopefully at some point soon we can line up some time to speak with Brad Steiger. But all that aside, Chris, do you recall what a Vimana is?
Yes.
Would you like to tell us what a Vimana is?
It's a...
I was just waiting for the... No.
Why?
I do know, but I'm not going to tell you. No, it's...
What's a Vimana, Chris? Why?
It's a craft that was described in the... I mean, overall, the Mahabharata.
Yeah.
Inclusively... crud, what's the...
Oh, what the
Bhagavad Gita? The Bhagavad Gita.
Well, I mean, I think that they may be mentioned through a number of the Vedic texts. So, yes, and I wasn't trying to put you on the spot.
No, that's fine.
Oh, I thought it would be good to have you tell us what they are, because I'm about to get into this, and I'm a little bit perplexed as to specifically why they're calling this a Vimana.
Well, they were described as flying chariots on which the gods rose to... to participate in their little god wars, and a lot of paleo contact people like to or infer that they are quite possibly alien aircraft that defies the laws of or with anti-gravitic technology, if in fact the assumption that what we perceived as gods in the past were in fact flesh and blood alien beings.
Right. You know, again, this is a subject we have talked about a lot on this program. Now, I'll just be honest with you. I got a lot of emails, as we always do, about Giorgio's appearance on the program last week. And you know, I think that Giorgio is very well-reasoned, and he articulates his points very well. For all we know, okay, for all we know, in ancient times, maybe we were visited by flesh and blood extraterrestrials. I'm not going to tell you we weren't, because I don't know. I wasn't there. Okay, but...
You got it.
Oh, yeah, I think we're... Watch out, that was a dig. I didn't have anything to do with that.
I'm sorry, that was slow.
No, it's fine. I mean,
slow.
I'm totally okay with the idea that the flesh and blood aliens could have visited our Earth in our Paleolithic times because of a key phrase, flesh and blood.
Flesh and blood.
Flesh and blood.
But could it have been either or flesh or blood? Maybe not one and the other?
We are the blood people.
Yes. Yes. It could have been the flesh and or the blood. They aren't mutually exclusive to one another. Either way, while that is certainly possible, I don't think, in my own interpretation, that it is perhaps the most likely scenario. And a lot of ancient alien theorists believe, and you know what's funny is Giorgio even took, he mentioned that he took issue with how on the program Ancient Aliens, I can't even talk tonight, Ancient Aliens, they always have that tagline, but according to ancient alien theorists who believe, ancient alien theorists believe, you know, and he said, but it's not about belief. Now, according to Giorgio, he feels that he has, in his lifetime, in his travels, in his studies, found evidence that he thinks supports rather conclusively that that there were some kind of exchange, or that there were some varieties of contact in ancient times between physical beings, those from here and those from elsewhere, and that technology was essentially brought to Earth in that manner. I think that could also very well have happened in an entirely non-physical capacity. And if anyone would like to explore that potential a little more, I direct you to a book called, well, there are a number of books, but probably one of the best ones is, what was the book that Strassman and Slavik wrote?
Inner Paths to Outer Space.
That's the one, yeah. See, I was thinking also of a book that Swami, I think it was Prabhupada, who had written this back in the 70s, Easy Journey to Other Planets. But it's interesting that that one came to mind just as well, because there are a number of references, both in spiritual capacities and also in terms of the ethnobotany and the entheobotany underlying psychedelic substances, the potential for leaving the known physical capacities of the mind and entering an altered state in which some believe that you could actually have some sort of a discourse with an intelligence, okay, but not in a physical way. In fact, in my book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, I talk about how sentient intelligences may very well utilize the realms of thought, the realms of, you know, the mind, dreamscapes, and altered states of consciousness especially, to communicate with other sentient intelligences. And if anything, these drawings that we see in cave art from ancient times that seem to depict non-humans, if they weren't just the interpretations of the imagination or just drawings of, you know, imaginary artists of that day, then perhaps these were indeed representations of things that people had seen in dreams or in altered states. And what if we were given knowledge of intelligence and certain advanced concepts through that kind of a non-physical medium? I think that that's something that should be taken into consideration just as well. It might still be something we could term as an extraterrestrial exchange, okay, with what we would call humans, ancient humans, but I don't think in an entirely physical way like most ancient astronaut theorists tend to propose, okay? Now, all that to say, this term Vimana, which as Chris has pointed out, seems to denote flying craft that were represented in the Sanskrit documents of ancient India. Okay, and now Vimana means a number of different things. It can also mean a tower. It can also mean a building. It can mean a certain kind of a ritual. But most people, in terms of ancient astronaut theory, refer to Vimanas in relation to flying craft referred to in texts like the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, and certain others.
Real quick question involving the Vimanas, but before I bring it up as any kind of, I guess, ammo or support for the argument.
Okay, sure.
I'm sorry, I've lost my words tonight.
I think we're all losing our minds after that great debate.
Arguing with Matt really took a lot of my vocabulary away.
I'm still at it. Come on.
Has
round two!
has the Vimana Shastra been proven or found to be kind of like a modern compilation or not necessarily an ancient text that someone just kind of put together?
That, as I understand the document you're referring to, many have used that as evidence, or if you, I think to borrow your term, ammunition, that supports the technological presence underlying Vimanas. In other words, not as some sort of a spirit vessel that the gods traveled in, but that literally Vimanas were some kind of a technical device, some sort of a machinery capable of advanced propulsion, physics, not known to ancients as we understand it, and presumably some kind of a physics that is still unknown to us today. Hence many assert that if these things did exist, that they were alien in nature. Yes, there is a document known as the Vimana Shastra, I believe, that seems to point to essentially blueprints of how these craft operated, that refer to such things as a mercury combustion engine that these craft were allegedly piloted through the air utilizing. And this is, of course, very advanced technology for today, let alone presumably 3,000 to 5,000 years ago in modern-day Pakistan and surrounding areas. And then, of course, there's the Nazi tie-in as well, because we know that the Nazis during the Second World War were incredibly interested in the Vedas and the Sanskrit epics, and many conspiracy theorists have asserted that they may have actually taken information that they had gleaned from these documents and applied it to the kinds of very advanced physics projects that were going on, like De Glocke, that Bell project that researchers like Joseph Farrell and Jim Mars and others have said that, you know, as a matter of fact, they've said Wernher von Braun, Hermann Oberth, and others were probably involved in this secret physics project known as the Bell, which, although it may or may not have had to do with aviation, it certainly had to do with advanced physics. Some people say that the knowledge, okay, that entailed, that the Nazis were perfecting during the Second World War, in which it may have remained clandestine, and aspects of it may have even held over into modern times in very clandestine, secretive ways. Many assert that that technology could have been influenced or inspired by or even taken directly from knowledge of the ancients, discerned from documents like the ancient Sanskrit. Okay, and so this term Vimana has become kind of a catch-all for what we essentially term as ancient UFOs, whether they were of some sort of terrestrial origin and designed by people in ancient times with very advanced technology that somehow was wiped off the face of the earth, and almost all evidence of it was taken, spirited away, or destroyed in such a fashion that once humanity began again, we have found very little evidence to support their existence several thousands of years ago. Now, I've made an argument that after several thousands of years, a lot of evidence of an advanced civilization could indeed disappear. It is at least plausible. Maybe not likely, but it is at least plausible. I've written an essay about that that appeared in the New Page books, Exposed, Uncovered, and Declassified, Secrets of the Past. I really do have a hard time remembering the titles of all these different books and anthologies and things. Try working in the media sometimes, folks. But anyway, all that said, I wrote an article about that, and I think it's at least plausible that if in ancient times terrestrial technology of that kind existed, and some sort of cataclysmic event occurred that wiped most of, if not all of, civilization as we knew it off the face of the earth, yes, that, you know, the majority of that evidence that you would expect that would last hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, well, after 3,000 to 5,000 years, truly might not have really held on as long as one would expect. And yet, the story here reads that the an alleged Vimana, what we take to be an ancient UFO, was found in a cave in Afghanistan. Now, I'm going to go ahead and say that, you know, erring to the typical thought process of my producer here, until I see conclusive proof, I'm not going to buy it. You hear these sorts of things all the time. But I'm bringing it up because it's interesting. It was mentioned on Coast to Coast AM recently, and not one but two of my field correspondents to this program wrote in talking about this and said that they were interesting, or that they were interested enough in this that they thought it would be worth talking about. And the headline essentially reads as follows: World leaders flock to Afghanistan after mysterious, quote-unquote, time well is discovered. A peculiar report. This is reported at the WordPress blog of Jimmy Prophet. A peculiar report prepared for Prime Minister Putin by Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service, circulating in the Kremlin today, states that German Chancellor Angela Merkel has become the latest in a growing line of Western leaders to make a surprise visit to Afghanistan this month. And this follows visits by the United States President Barack Obama, which occurred. Now, this is the thing. Okay, this story, and this is what I noticed about this, this information is apparently just now kind of getting out, but it's old news. It really is. The story dates back to December of last year. Okay?
Well, the question I have is, are these Western leaders going to Afghanistan, or are they going to Afghanistan with the specific purpose of seeing this thing?
Well, see, that's a good question. And that's the other thing. This is what was a red flag to me. Here we are. Barack Obama, our current commander-in-chief, is preparing to debate Mitt Romney tomorrow night. Okay, they're going to Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are going to have their first presidential debate tomorrow evening. And I'm reading this story, which again is just now apparently being mentioned, or at very least it was discussed on Coast to Coast AM, and therefore everyone's flocking to these stories and trying to find information about this now. And I see that Barack Obama had allegedly visited Afghanistan, supposedly for purposes of checking out this, what is being called, air quotes, a time well in Afghanistan. Maybe one more reason that we shouldn't withdraw, or maybe one more reason that we should withdraw. Fair and balanced. We're unbiased. Really, I promise. But nonetheless, I don't think that our current commander-in-chief would be taken off to Afghanistan when he should be at home washing his tights. No, preparing for a debate, okay? That was a clear indication, and I looked at that and I thought, wait a minute. And this thing dates back to the article I'm reading was apparently posted on February 12th, of last year, not 2012, of last year. So this information, apparently, that a lot of people are posting all over the web right now, and then I'm hearing about, it's old news. But they nonetheless talk about, and I found this interesting, and it's worth talking about here. They said that Barack Obama had visited Afghanistan for these purposes. British Prime Minister David Cameron had gone, and also Nicolas Sarkozy had visited as well. They said only Sarkozy's trip, this report says, was concealed as he was already in India on a state visit when rushed by a U.S. military aircraft to the Afghan war zone. What caused the sudden rush of these most powerful leaders of the Western world to go to Afghanistan? This report continues, was to directly view the discovery by U.S. military scientists of what is described as a Vimana, entrapped in a time well, that has already caused the disappearance of at least 8 American soldiers trying to remove it from the cave. Next thing we know, this thing's going to transport Barack Obama back in time so that he can visit himself on Mars when he was formerly a CIA operative.
And going by the name of, what was it?
Barry Satoro. And a member of DC's Teen Titans.
Exactly.
And he had a mutant power where he grew a second set of ears. But anyway.
I think that one's still with us. Oh.
From the ancient astronaut, or rather from the ancient accounts found in, which of course are a part of modern ancient astronaut theory, the Mahabharata describes Vimanas. They allegedly measured 12 cubits in circumference, and that they had 4 strong wheels, that they were capable of firing different kinds of advanced weaponry and blazing through the sky at incredible speed. Well, this is what they claimed had been found in Afghanistan. And that there was, again, to use the air quotes, a time well encasing this Vimana. It appears to have been an electromagnetic radiation gravity field. Well, we may not know what gravity is. Apparently, they did 5,000 years ago. And this is the sort of electromagnetic radiation gravity field first postulated by Albert Einstein as a unified field theory, and long rumored to be behind the infamous American World War II experiment in teleportation called the Philadelphia Experiment in 1943. See, 5,000 years of advanced physics that leads us directly to 1943 when a large anyway, we should do a whole show about Carlos Allende and the Philadelphia experiment, you know. Oh, goodness. But they say most intriguing of all about this report was that they stated that not just any Vimana had been discovered, but from the ancient writings contained in the cave where they found it, it claims that its rightful owner is the ancient prophet Zoroaster. Are you familiar with this ancient prophet, Chris?
I mean, vaguely.
Vaguely?
His was the philosophy on which a lot of Abrahamic religions are based.
Zoroastrianism or something like
yes.
that?
Yes. Oh, sorry, I was whispering. Yes.
Thank you, Whispering Chris Hayes.
Milkman!
Hey, I just want to go ahead and put it out there on the air. I know a couple of weeks ago or last week you were having a hard time finding the image RPJ drew of me being an awesome zombie milkman.
Yeah, oh, it's on.
But I finally saw it because I didn't check my email for like 3 weeks. But I saw it in RPJ. That is wonderful. I just have one question, not just for you, but also for Rosa, and really anyone who's ever drawn me. Why do you give me such a thick neck? My neck really isn't that thick, but I mean,
it's,
I appreciate it.
Huge.
It makes me feel like I'm really
it's
muscular.
It's almost like
but
your feet, dude.
Look, Matt, would you tell me?
Hey, my pancake feet are a huge sore subject for me, all right?
You know, I mean, there could be an ancient flying vessel that a mystic that Pliny the Elder called the inventor of magic that exists in a time well in Afghanistan. But would y'all please make his neck look a little smaller if you're going to draw him?
No, 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 no. Keep the neck. It's flattering. I like the big neck. I just want to know why, because all of my photographs, I don't have a big, thick neck. I really like the thick neck. It makes me look
You know what I say? Okay, hold on. Where's the book that I gave you, Matt? Let's get the book over here. Yeah, okay. I've talked enough about Vimanas. You know, now, but I'll tell you honestly, Vimanas are an endless source of inspiration for me. And even when I looked at that article and I realized, you know, this is 2 years old, I hadn't heard about that one. And apparently it had come up on Coast to Coast. And so, and if we were lucky, maybe one of our speakers, okay, had brought this up in the conversation. One of our speakers at Paradigm Symposium, because Vimanas, whatever they may have been, are an interesting subject to me, and I've always enjoyed that discussion. And so maybe we'll hear more about that at Paradigm Symposium. God, can you believe we're looking at, like, we're in the home stretch. It's already October.
2 weeks. 2 weeks from today.
2 weeks from today.
We depart for Minneapolis.
And we're going to be seeing so many of you out there in the listening audience at the Paradigm Symposium. I am so excited. I just got an email before we took the airwaves from Nick Redfern warning me that he's only got 45 minutes to catch the next terminal from where we're flying him to for the layover. And so, Nick, if you're out there listening, I certainly... hope you get there on time, and if not, we'll wait for you. Well, the show will not go on without Nick Redfern, I can promise you that.
Well, I want to tell you that Chris is so excited about Paradigm that he called me this afternoon screaming obscenities to see when we should
That's true, isn't it?
It's absolutely
there.
True.
And the people around me at the time were like, good Lord, I am never calling you because of the way you just had that exchange with
and
whoever
apparently you
that
guys
was.
Have been going all day like that.
And also on the other end of that phone call, I was at work and I did what I did. And a coworker of mine came out with a huge pipe wrench in his hand. He thought I was getting in a fight with someone who was trying to steal some of our equipment.
Well, the whispering Chris Hayes no more. Yeah, the screaming demon, the red man himself, Christopher Hayes.
Well, just when he's excited.
Well, yeah, he's red right now because he's worked up. But
I mean,
you know,
if we can edit it out of the podcast, I can do a reenactment for our live listeners.
Well, no, let's not do that. But I would like to say this. We're going to propose a contest right now. The first person who gets me a really good artistic rendering, okay, depending on how many we receive, we might have to do we're going to vote on the best of three, because I'd like to see a lot of these. I would like to see artistic renderings of Chris Hayes either as depicted as Satan, okay, a large red forked-tailed and horned devil, or as another gentleman with a very large neck, the Incredible Hulk, okay?
Just Hulk Hogan? I thought that'd be good,
no,
too.
No. Hulk Hogan isn't as interesting as Hulk Hayes.
I'll take the devil, and I'll take the Hulk. But why has it got to be the penistic Hulk? Hulk devil. Why can't it be like the cool, suave devil? Like,
because I want to see
like
you,
the dad from Twin Peaks.
No.
The devil and Reaper.
I want you to be like the devil from the old Tom Cruise movie Legend, okay? Chris Hayes.
You want me to be Tim Curry?
Yeah, I want you to be Tim Curry. I want you to look like that. Or I want you to look like Hulk Hayes.
I want
to,
Chris, you
just
going to
walk around to
actually,
people.
Actually, there is a Red Hulk, just so you
okay.
know.
Okay, Red Hulk Chris versus Green Hulk Chris.
No, Tim Curry Chris just walks around to people and goes, hey, we all float down here.
Or Tim Curry versus Chris. We could do Tim Curry versus Chris.
Can you imagine
Chris?
Tim Curry as the devil from... Legend. Why am I forgetting words? From Legend, singing Sweet Transvestite from Transsexual Transylvania.
Okay, well, as a little tribute to Richard O'Brien, then we could also do this one. Hulk Hayes versus Tim Curry from Rocky Horror Picture Show in the spirit of the season. Any of those,
or you can just draw me in drag. That works too.
Any of those things, any of those will meet the criteria. The best drawing that we receive, okay, the winner receives a copy of this brand new book that I've written. It's called Reynolds Mansion, An Invitation to the Past. Let me just tell you, I'm going to read to you directly from the back of the book, okay? Hey, I'm authorized to do that. I wrote what's on the back of the book.
Oh, okay. Did you also write the endorsements?
No, I didn't.
This is awesome! George Norrie. .. about scallops.
Yeah, George Norrie is quoted on the back of this book saying, it's not obscene.
It's just haunted.
It's just haunted. All right. I'm going to read a brief excerpt. This is a true ghost story. Chris here, Chris, our producer, Matt, our engineer, yours truly, and several other friends of the Graylian Report, people who have been guests on the program before, and people who are regular listeners, field correspondents, confidants, best friends, you know, all that good stuff. They're all characters in this book. And so you're going to read about actual psychic investigations and research that Chris Hayes and Matt Oakley and I and several others have done. Our adventures at a location known as the Reynolds Mansion here in Asheville, North Carolina. The subtitle of the book is The History and Strange Happenings at a Southern Antebellum Home. Now, I know some of you out there listening are probably like already on Amazon looking for this book. You will be able to buy this book in just a few days on Amazon.com. This is an advanced release right here. Matt Oakley here is one of the first people who actually has gotten a copy. And yes, Chris, you're going to get one also. Don't worry. Neither of you will leave the bunker tonight and get on that elevator and head back up to Terra Firma. Hold on. Without a copy of this book.
Now, are we going to continue on in the way of things you write in the inside jacket of books you give to us?
Yes, I'm going to have to write something really good. Well, see, this one comes already with prepackaged with the letter R for, can you guess what that stands for? Stands for Red Hulk, actually.
Oh, yes. Okay. I was hoping it wasn't rutabagas because those are disgusting.
Yeah. No, actually, it's R as in Ramon, okay? I have my tights on and I am ready to come to the United States.
Ramon, your Cuban lover.
Ramon? Yes, this book is dedicated to Ramon. All right. Reynolds Mansion is among the oldest remaining antebellum homes in the southeastern United States. Within its halls and corridors, one will find a wealth of history about the house, shared through family portraits and pictures that adorn the walls, as well as colorful antiques and the dazzling additions of its present owners. And I'm getting a little choked up watching Chris over here in the corner as he dismays me. Though it serves today as a top-rated bed and breakfast, the unique southern home is also a treasure trove of mysteries for those who seek the more strange and unusual aspects our lives can offer. Hello! That's us. Enter Chris, Matt, and Micah. Here in the historic Reynolds family home, the essences of hard-living pioneers, a controversial North Carolina senator, as well as the nurturing presence of a young girl long departed from this world can all be felt by those who enter today. And here one man's hopeful attempts at unraveling the mansion's many mysteries will reveal parts of its incredible story that have remained obscured for decades, of course, until right now. This is the story of Reynolds Mansion and those who remain there today among its hidden residents. Let me tell you, I've never probably been to one place that had more really good ghost stories. And so the first person who gets me one of those aforementioned monstrosity versions of Chris Hayes, you're going to get a free copy of this new book just in time for the Halloween season. Halloween happens to be one of our favorite holidays that we celebrate here on the Graylian Report. And so for the month of October, we're going to be celebrating Croctember like we do every year. And so next hour, kicking off our Croctember celebration. Yes, Croctober, actually.
I think we change the name every year anyway.
Well, I'm not going to tell them what
matter.
We say. We're going to tell you about it when we come back right after this on the Graylian Report. Stay tuned.
For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grinion Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Taking you right up to the end of the month, where we celebrate what we call Croctober Halloween here on the Grinion Report. That's right. Or is it October? October, September, Croctember, somewhere in between, no doubt. And, of course, we here, the Grailian Gang, lie somewhere between the fabric, between what is real and what is not. Our dark little corner of the web known as the Grailian Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, joined in studio, as always, by Mr. Chris Hayes and engineer Matthew Oakley. I'm going to put this one out to the folks in the chat room. We're going to talk about something really creepy and Croctobery here, kicking off our month-long celebration of the Halloween season. But I've got a really good conspiracy story that we could get to. And I'm going to ask the folks in the chat room listening right now, do we want to hear a conspiracy story before or after we get into the Creepsville stuff? Okay? Because we've got some really good creepy stuff. In fact, I'm going to ask you guys, too, what do you think? Hey, producer, why don't you produce something over here? Should we get to this creepy conspiracy story now? Or later.
That looks like a lot of words on that there paper. I think we should just skip it entirely. No, can we do kind of like a mashup? Like every paragraph you read part of the Croctober thing, and I read part of the conspiracy thing, and it's like a weird all-encompassing story.
Who done it?
Okay, fine. Do the conspiracy first.
We have a vote for the conspiracy first here, Matthew. Now
sure,
or later.
Sure. Fine. I'll agree with Chris this once. All right.
Huh. I might let you guys.
I'm kidding.
I don't want your charity. I don't need your charity, Matt.
Well, I may allow you guys to override the wishes of those in the chat room. Okay, we're going to get to this conspiracy story first, and then unfortunately, this is going to have to tide you over for just a few more minutes because we're going to get to the creeps here in just a few. And trust me, there's... Okay, yeah, I'm seeing... Actually, they're changing their minds. Now in the chat room, they're saying, let's hear it now. Come on, right now. Let me begin this by saying this one's pretty creepy, too. Not as creepy as what we're about to talk about. But this one's pretty creepy. And this one is pretty real world. I mean, this is stuff that's going on out there in the world right now. Why, I will ask, is an exclusive group, a secret society, if you will, collecting our children's DNA? And furthermore, why are they doing this with the apparent support of police and the government across the United States and Canada? Now, this sounds like something probably from a... what's the guy's name? Brad Metzler or Meltzer? What's the guy's name?
Yeah, Brad Meltzer, the guy who writes... fiction, the guy who writes books that are as good as Dan Brown's. I don't know. It's all bunk.
Well, let's just say Dan Brown then. Sounds like something out of a Dan Brown novel. Okay. Have you ever heard of the Masonic chip?
I have three.
You have three Masonic chips? Well, the Huffington Post recently reported on the Masonic chip. Okay, let me tell you what this is, essentially. In Massachusetts, a Freemason program was promoted by CBS News from the steps of the official state house. And it included their police dog coincidentally named Mason. Verger.
What now? Where's my juice?
Well, reporters only failed to mention, okay, apparently, according to this Huffington Post report, that the private nod to those promoting this, the government had little to do with this program, okay, involving these so-called Masonic chips. And so people are probably wondering out there, what is a Masonic chip? Well, get this. It begins on the surface as a child identification project in case your loved ones are ever to be horrendously abducted. God forbid that that ever happened. That is truly terrifying. Parents are familiar with the at-home kits to record their kids' vital information for protection against the greatest of all fears. Normally, height, weight, hair, and eye color are recorded along with a set of fingerprints and hopefully a, you know, fairly up-to-date photograph of the child, which subsequently may appear on a milk carton or something like that. Now, as posed in this report here, it's just the good folks at your local Masonic Lodge saw it fit to take these things a little further. Now, according to this news story, with advances in technology, they began to offer digital fingerprints, digital imaging, digital video, dental impressions, and DNA from mouth swabs, and all this sort of stuff that could be processed digitally. Well, this data processing is managed by their proprietary software that's designed to be compatible with local and national law enforcement. This is, after all, a campaign created by police in the Brotherhood, the Masonic Order. I've been told often that many, and actually I've got a lot of friends who are Masons, okay? I'm not demonizing anybody. I'm just reading a report here to you. As a matter of fact, as a musician, performed at Masonic lodges before and been friends with a lot of, you know, the heads of the various Masonic lodges here around Asheville. But they say here, a great distinction is made to ensure governments are nothing more than their supporters. Freemasons assert ownership of this project as an integral part of their mission statement, okay, which is to instill safety identification initiatives, okay, developed in order to help in collaboration with or in cooperation with law enforcement and the like, and all together for the safety of children. But now this is where it gets a little strange, okay? They claim their services are superior to what a parent could accomplish at home by recording the child's data personally and then providing their own quote-unquote healthcare professionals to collect DNA samples. We've heard stories similar to this for years now about the collection of DNA without a person's knowledge. Another way that they had hoped to be able to gather this genetic information would be at the time of birth. Okay, I'd read a similar story a while back that talked about where hospitals would hope to gather and record this kind of data at the time of birth with newborn babies. So, allegedly, there are also Freemason organizations that are interested in doing this as well, as the Huffington Post and other news agencies have been reporting. Now, there's no way to guarantee what happens behind closed doors, and although they claim to delete sensitive information, okay, a Canadian website states that, quote, no information is ever stored by the Masonic chip program. Any computer-savvy person knows that clicking an X isn't permanent unless you format the entire system. You know, when it comes to the full-body scanners, when they were first tested in the District of Columbia, they were saying the same things. Oh, there won't be any images of people that are stored on these machines. But the images, of course, were still stored on those machines, and then they were accessed later, and then many of them were released in files that appeared in videos and other collections available for download on the web. And so, although you couldn't really discern who you're looking at, there were dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of images of people in the buff that appeared online, and as a result of these full-body scanners that, oh, they won't save your information, they won't record personal information, like naked pictures of you standing in a Washington, D.C. courthouse. No, that's not going to be released. Nobody will ever see that. Parents are asked to trust an intriguing private fraternity the author writes, to ensure that quality standards are met and family privacy is legally respected without any kind of oversight. Because Freemasons fund 100% of the initiative, there's no opportunity to discuss issues regarding data ownership or how they feel about those technicalities in the privacy of their meetings. So, is this sort of information actually being gathered? And if so, what is the interest in gathering DNA from children, whether it be at the time of birth in hospitals or through these Masonic chip programs and things like that? Are you comfortable with that? Would you be comfortable with people gathering genetic information about your child? For good or for ill, is that information that you want somebody to have access to? Somebody outside your home or your family, or maybe your doctor's office? I don't know. I think that's a little strange personally. I find that one maybe just a little odd, but then again, that's probably just me. But then again, it is my honor to bring that kind of information to you here on the program. Something to think about. And when we come back, we're going to give you several somethings to think about, because I tell you, people are pretty creepy. But there's only maybe one thing that's creepier than people, and that's non-people. We'll be talking about non-people when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Back to the program. Yeah, I don't know how you feel about that sort of, it's not really genetic tampering, but it's certainly gaining access to genetic information. What do they want to do that? Or with that, rather? What? Do they want to clone us? Do they want to make little Hadal babies? Super soldiers? Speaking of Hadals, by the way, you know, that really figures in with what we're about to talk about. Might as well, as opposed to Croctober, call it Creeptober. Because what is creepier? Now, I'll tell you, I think we've all had experiences. You know, you're walking down the street, it's late at night, and across the street from you, you see one of those creepy individuals. You're not sure if they're looking at you or not. You just hope they're not. And you keep on walking. You're headed back to your home. You get further down the street, and you turn around. And not only was that person who was standing there leaning on the lamppost across the street from you, looking ominously in your direction, not only is that person still in view, they're walking down the street.
Are you talking about the grinning man?
They're following you. Yeah. I'm talking about the grinning man. I'm talking about shadow people. I'm talking about all these different manifestations, non-human entities. Humanoids, they look kind of human, but they're not really human.
Well, if you really want to scare one of our listeners in particular, we could talk about the black-eyed children.
You know, we've still got to... I put a call out to David Weatherly, actually, to try and get him on the show, and he is traveling right now. As a matter of fact, actually, I think he was in Kentucky at Scarefest. Yeah.
It's an original name.
He was at Scarefest. He was trying to get me to come up and visit at Scarefest, and I haven't been in touch. You know, David and I have both been very busy, but David's the author of the book The Black-Eyed Children. We have a copy of it here in the studio. I definitely want to have him on the program to talk about that. And he's going to be at Paradigm Symposium, no doubt talking about that and various other things. What is it, though? I wonder sometimes. This is a cultural thing. These sort of human types that aren't really humans. In his book Caverns, Cauldrons, and Concealed Creatures, my good friend Mike Mott wrote about a story where a guy had been driving down the interstate, okay, and he's heading along, And I think, or maybe the story had been that this guy was hitchhiking. I know that the way that the story went, though, that he came up on this overpass, and he was driving, either walking along or driving down along this stretch of highway, and the overpass where the highway intersected it came up over and above, and he said that there was this person that he could see from in the distance standing up there on top of this overpass. And that as he got closer and he was able to see this person, once he got closer, he said that it looked like, at first, just a guy with a hoodie. And then as he got closer, he began to discern that this person, okay, with the hoodie, wasn't really so much a person as it was a thing. He said it looked like it was a humanoid, but it had a frog's face, and that this thing was looking right at him. And you hear about these stories. Chris, you, of course, mentioned the grinning man.
Yeah, who scares the bejesus out of me.
Why does he scare you? What is it about the grinning? Well, first, tell us about who exactly the grinning man is.
Well, from my studies, there are actually two instances of grinning men. I believe they are, in fact, unrelated. But the most notorious or well-known one is the grinning man who was seen... What was it, in New Jersey?
Yeah, back in the late 1960s, I believe.
Yeah, on just outside of a fence on the Jersey Turnpike, the grinning man is believed to either precede or coincide with UFO sightings or landings.
Yeah, the story had initially gone that there were a couple of guys. Remember, one's name was Jimmy. Don't remember the other kids.
They were kids. They were like 14 and 15.
Yeah, they were teenagers, and they were walking along. And there'd been a story that had been taking place there in town, where a woman had claimed she was chased by a tall man in a green jumpsuit. Okay, so the Riddler's chasing people around your neighborhood.
That's my name's Edward Nygma.
Yeah, that's creepy enough as it is, especially if it looks anything like Jim Carrey in a green spandex suit. Now, that said, what?
The worst would be if Jim Carrey showed up in that sequined suit from the final scene in Batman Forever. Yeah, that really would really freak people out.
I think that would probably kill them on sight. Yeah. If looks could kill, yeah, his looks could kill. Well, anyway, so the story had been that there was this, but this guy wasn't a little skinny dweeb like the Riddler. This guy was huge, and he had allegedly chased a woman there in that neighborhood. Well, so Jimmy and his friend are walking along, and they get over by this fence, and one of the kids says to the other, "Good God, look at that guy standing over there." And on the other side of this fence, they said, was this incredibly massive proportioned individual, this huge man wearing, again, this green kind of skin-tight coverall suit. And the man, they said, leaned over the fence and down right toward them and just grinned, this great, big, ghastly, creepy grin. And so stories like these are told from time to time. Now, I argue, and I wrote recently for Mysterious Universe, that I think a lot of these stories, taken out of context, a couple of kids say that they met, you know, Robert Wadlow wearing a jumpsuit standing over here, okay, and taken out of context, late at night, you know, some dude standing out there being, you know, really creepy. What he was doing on the other side of that fence, nobody knows, nobody wants to know.
I mean, in a green skin tight jumpsuit, you're not really hiding much.
No, you're not.
He's probably just standing there.
Leaves very little to the imagination.
Unless they were just really focused on his eyes.
Yeah, yeah. This piercing.
Don't look down.
Oh God, I'm getting creeped out. People forget how dark it is down here in the bunker. Okay, so anyway, these stories could very well be and likely are in most instances encounters with just weird looking people. Okay. You guys encountered a weird-looking person downtown in Asheville a while back. No comment. I'm just saying you did. No comment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no comment.
It took me... Because I see... Because of the frequency with which I am downtown, I see a lot of strange folken.
a lot of hadals, no doubt.
Yeah, yeah. This one took the proverbial cake.
Yeah,
if you will.
There are some, yeah, see, there are some strange things, but these, I think, are nonetheless people. And yet there are these areas of study where some of these stories of quote-unquote sightings of weird people are so weird that they don't necessarily fit into just a random encounter with an odd-looking person. Some of these things seem to involve, well, non-humans. And where it gets really strange is where these non-humans are encountered. Not just on ground level, but sometimes underwater. Sometimes there are humanoids that are seen flying around.
I just got a flash of the grinning man underwater, like waving to a sub with little air bubbles popping out between his huge teeth.
I mean, that would be creepy, wouldn't it? That would be really creepy. But there are stories of encounters with non-human humanoids that occur on land, sea, air, just about everywhere you can imagine. And so for this segment of the Croctober celebration, we're going to look at a few classic humanoid encounters. We'll kick this one off with this story of giant humanoids seen in Portugal. The year was 1980, near a location known as Ponte do Sor, again in Portugal. It was approximately 11 o'clock in the morning. Broad daylight. A 55-year-old farmer, known as Mr. Paveo, had left his farm taking his sheep to the fields. He was walking along. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. His sheep were calm, but he heard a noise. At the same time, his dog, on the other hand, did begin to panic. The dog starts acting really erratic. What's going on, he thinks. Well, he began to feel, based on the way that his dog was behaving, that there might be something going on behind him. Well, he turns and he was very surprised to see what he described as 2 8-foot-tall humanoids. They didn't look human, but they were human-shaped. They were very close, and they were staring right at him. Now, he described them as very strong-looking. They were wearing gray suits. Mr. Paveo said that their faces resembled humans, but their eyes and their skin was different. It was disturbing. Their hands were hairy and very, very big. Well, these two beings approached the witness, making friendly gestures. Of course, yes. I always love it when a really big creep shows up making friendly gestures. Oh, come over. Come over and join us.
Come join us, Danny.
Well, as they approached making their friendly gestures, one touched his left shoulder and then began to touch, as the report here I'm reading says, several other parts of his body. At the same time, they spoke in a strange language with a modulation that sounded kind of like a human's voice, but nonetheless, it was something, well, it was a bit unsettling, something a little different, something a little off. Now, one of the beings, when they pointed to the sheep and Mr. Paveo told him the type of animal it was, meanwhile, the two beings kept talking and laughing. And the witness then gave an order to his dog to fetch one of the sheep. When he looked back at the beings, he saw an intense flash of light, which blinded him for a few seconds. And then after that, the beings had just disappeared. Where did they go? Mr. Paveo didn't know whether to be terrified. He didn't know whether to be perplexed. He didn't really know what to think. But he'd had this experience, and he claimed indeed, yes, there were strange beings that he had met on the road that day. It reminded me of another story. You know, I visited, I love the little south, the southern islands off the coast of South Carolina, Georgia, and places like that. Dolfuski Island, I've told the listeners many times that I, at least twice a year, go down to haunted Dolfuski and spend a couple of days out there on Bloody Point. You know, John Mellencamp has a house down there, and often you'll see John and Meg Ryan hanging around on Dolfuski Island. It's very quiet, very calm down there. Well, I also visited another island a few years ago called St. Simon's Island, okay, which is near Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia. And I just happened to stop in a little bookstore down there, a little used bookstore on maybe the only one there on St. Simon's Island. In addition to this bookstore, there were a few nice restaurants, one Dairy Queen, and lots of armadillos. But who'd have thunk that I'd find this book that I hold now here in my grayly and green fingertips, The World Atlas of UFOs, Sightings, Abductions, and Close Encounters by John Spencer. And I remembered a full-color illustration that appears in this book that accompanies the following report of an encounter, well, with some really, really strange and really big, well, quasi-humans, maybe, something human-like. The Soviet news agency TASS almost gave way to sensationalism in 1989, only 9 years after the Portuguese report we just read, when it reported a flying saucer landing in a suburban Russian park. However, the report certainly had credibility as the involvement of scientists investigating the area showed, and perhaps reflected maybe the liberalization taking place in the country's media at the time. Now, according to the report, a UFO had landed in a suburban park at Voronezh, some 300 miles south of Moscow. Witnesses said that they saw two gigantic entities. They were walking nearby. They were described as tall and thin, but with tiny heads, and that they apparently had a small, robot-like creature that accompanied them. Interestingly, the proportions are the exact opposite of most Western alien descriptions we hear about big heads and little bodies. These guys were huge and had little, tiny heads. Very interesting. An investigation of the ensuing UFO flap was slow, but it appeared that the date of this writing, the time that the book that I'm citing here was written, that there had indeed been a wave of sightings in that area at the time. They said that after the giants left the area, they were seen by a few individuals there in a location. There had been a milkmaid who had claimed that they had seen one of these, what she described as being a being who was taller than average with this really small head. Many of the witnesses had been gripped with sheer terror after seeing these things. Something about these giant... I mean, think about that. You're walking along and you see this huge person with this little tiny head and a robot on a leash walking along. You'd be scared too. So scientists went to the location. They decided to take measurements of the alleged sighting, or the site where a flying saucer had been seen. They did find a wide depression in the grass, 4 deep dents, which are regarded as landing trace evidence. Who knows who those large beings were? And there's an accompanying illustration here in the book that seems to indicate that they, well, seemed humanoid, but that they weren't quite human. So what were they? Aliens from outer space? Or something else? It's strange. Now, those aliens, of course, flew here. If they were indeed aliens, whatever the case may be, those beings appeared to have arrived in a craft of some sort. But that's not how all of these non-human entities get around, okay? I have here a book that we referenced earlier in the program. A book, actually, to which I was a contributor. This is called Real Monsters, Gruesome Critters, and Beasts from the Dark Side by Brad Steiger. I contributed a couple of folk tales, if you will, about snakes, such as the legend of what is called a hoop snake. And those appear in this book, but this book also, like all of Brad's book, it's just chock full of really strange stories of people's encounters with, well, in this instance, it's strange creatures, but there's an anthology like this about ghosts. There's one that's all about conspiracies. There's one that's all about zombies and creatures of the apocalypse. There's one that's all about vampires, one that's all about werewolves. So there's really one for every occasion. Oh, and there's one about space aliens as well.
And don't forget the secret societies one, Micah.
Well, I said conspiracies, the conspiracies, which is really one of my favorites. It's fantastic. As a matter of fact,
I flipped through it. It's absolutely phenomenal.
That book, Brad, actually, the first edition of that book had just come out, and he was actually promoting that when I was first introduced to Brad, okay? But like all his books, he tends to be one of these people who can find a lot of information that you're not gonna find elsewhere. And this story, this isn't a giant humanoid. The whole purpose of this discussion, I want to kind of, you know, go over all the different varieties of weird humanoids. Some of them are giant. Then there are the stories of, oh, our favorite here in the Moho, the ones that live in caves. Those are the creepy ones. But some of these things are said to be winged or be capable of flying. You hear these stories of the Brujas in Mexico, stories of black-caped witches that have attacked even police officers, flying humanoids in the Middle Americas. Very, very strange. And in Latin America, well, this is sort of one of those stories. On the evening of Sunday, September 30th, Brad notes that he had first been given information, maybe somewhat anecdotally, about an encounter someone had had with some sort of a strange being. Well, he said he had an informant who claimed that it was his brother who had actually witnessed this being and would go and visit this gentleman. Now, there was a little bit of a backstory to this, which involved a winged and very terrifying-looking being. In his reality-checking column in the October 2007 issue of Alternate Perceptions, the editor, Brent Rains, a well-known researcher of the unexplained, an author of a book called Visitors from Hidden Realms, well, he quoted an informant of his who had described a recent sighting of an apparent, what he called a birdman, that was actually seen in New Mexico, in a desert community called Chaparral. Well, the witness's brother, who spoke English, had contacted Brent, and he said that the informant visited his brother's next-door neighbor with a cell phone in hand, and he had agreed to help me get the lowdown on this man's incredible account with what he termed a bird man. Now, the neighbor was a truck driver. He spoke only Spanish, and so my informant agreed, being an English speaker, to act as an interpreter for me. So back and forth we went between English and Spanish, back to English repeatedly, so that I could get the details. The man acting as an interpreter and gathering details from this truck driver who claimed to have had this terrifying encounter. Here's what he described. It was early, early in the morning, probably about 2 or 3 a.m., and he had initially thought that something was coming toward his dog, who he had taken outside, and was going to try and attack it. Well, the dog went back in and then started barking really loud. He said he'd noticed that there was nothing around. It's much like the earlier story we read where the man taking his sheep along, the dog started acting strangely. This dog is just going nuts. And the witness noticed that a tree nearby had apparently been swaying back and forth. Something was causing motion, but he noticed, well, that's funny, there didn't seem to be a whole lot of wind. But this tree was moving like there was a windstorm going on. There had to be something in the tree, and so naturally he looks up. That's when he saw it. Now, there weren't feathers, but this thing, it looked humanoid. It had a tiny head. Sounds familiar? But this thing also had big fanged teeth, sharp claws on the hands that he could see. He made a point of emphasizing that this thing did indeed have hands in addition to what appeared to be wings. Now, as best as the witness could recall, the incident had occurred, again, around 2 or 3 a.m. It was early August or late July. The year was 2007. He'd gone outside. It was very dark. He was planning to smoke a cigarette, had his dog with him, when he heard this commotion from the tree. He flicked his lighter, and that's when he saw it. You know what? My informant and interpreter on the other end of the phone said. He said that it made a horrible sound, kind of like he couldn't even describe it. It was like a squealing, but a really, really loud scream. I guess like in between maybe a crow's screech and sort of a hissing sound. Well, this creature had been making this noise, sitting there in the tree, and the witness had been so shocked. He said, I kept trying to turn on my lighter so that I could maybe get a better look at this thing. I was almost too shocked to run, and the lighter was the only source of light that I actually had. And the beast all the while kept making this sound. This animal kept making this noise. We said he didn't think that this huge bird creature saw him until he started lighting his lighter. He said the birdman came down the way that an eagle lands. And that's the position that he saw him in. Kind of like with his front legs up in the air? Brent had asked. Exactly. And with his hands balled up close to his chest. Now, when asked about how this creature looked, he said it was huge. This bird man, as he described it, was about 6 feet tall or more. And as and again, this was all being told to him in English by a man who was interpreting from the Spanish. So the interpreter begins to tell him, he says, okay, he's telling me that to him it probably lasted a long time, this sighting, but that it might have been like 5 or 6 seconds. He wasn't really sure. Now, interestingly, this is something that a lot of people report when they have these sorts of experiences. Especially in ufology, we hear of what they call missing time, where somebody thinks that they're just spending 5 or 6 seconds, and they'll find out later maybe an hour or two had passed, maybe more. He didn't seem to be really sure about how much time had transpired. He just remembered this thing landing on a garage roof, and he said it sat there briefly in a squatted position watching him. He said the birdman turned around, looked at him again, kind of the way an owl tilts its head, and then it made that same blood-curdling noise before it took off flying. And he said when this thing flew, it took off in the direction of nearby mountains and flew really fast. The history of Fortiana is absolutely rife with stories like that. Stories of birdmen. You know, there was an alleged birdman that was seen flying and doing what were described as aerial gymnastics around the turn of the last century over Coney Island. There was also a report from Vietnam, I believe, during the Vietnamese conflict, where, if I recall correctly, there had been two men on a watchtower, and they described seeing what looked like a beautiful nude woman, but her skin was very dark, maybe even covered in some sort of a fur, and that she had wings and had been flying along, and that they observed this woman as she flew by. Not quite human, again.
Did she have bird feet?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Because maybe she was a hot harpy.
Maybe so. You know, it's just, it's very strange. What does one make of these kinds of stories? Now, they could all be made up. They could be the results of hallucinations. There could be overactive imaginations, you know. There was, there were also stories of a, gosh, you know, if I remember correctly, again, there was a what was described as a Batman, very similar to the story that we just read about the Birdman of Mexico, a Batman that was seen in Texas, where, again, a apparently winged but humanoid-looking personage landed in a tree and watched those from a distance that had spotted this strange creature. And, of course, we can't forget the stories of the Mothman of West Virginia. Now, of course, I've debated whether indeed the Mothman was indeed a winged humanoid or if it was not a combination of different reports of large birds and Bigfoot-type creatures that were being seen, as John Keel himself later proposed of the mystery. But you can't rule out whether or not Mothman was a true winged being, that there are a lot of stories, if you dig around, there are a lot of stories of winged or flying humanoids that people come across. Very strange. And just to further prove that no space is sacred, there are the stories of the underwater humanoids just as well. Truly. Here's another one. This one comes from the Church of Ufology Blogspot website. A story of underwater humanoids that came from near Odessa, by the Black Sea in the Ukraine. Three young Ukrainian divers had gone on a morning dive equipped with aqualungs in order to explore the bottom of the Black Sea in an area several dozen kilometers southeast of Odessa. Now, this area had interested them since on an earlier dive they had found a strange crater-like hollow on the seafloor. On the edge of the crater jutted a strange cube-shaped sort of rock that was covered in cockle shells and other water plants. And apparently the area was totally different from the rest of the ocean floor in other locations, and so they decided to return to this locale. They dove toward that strange cubic rock and attempted to pick some of the cockle shells out of it, but suddenly, this is very interesting, the divers claimed as they were diving to have heard, this was reported in a newspaper from Moscow in 2004 called The Secret Power, the divers all claimed that they heard a voice as though it had been speaking straight into their heads. The voice was telling them, don't do that, don't do that. Well, these words were repeated several times, and all the divers claimed to have heard this, quote-unquote, heard this voice saying, don't do that, leave that alone. Well, amazingly, the crater that they had intended to return to at this underwater site had now vanished, and the men suddenly saw a remarkable set of what appeared to be ancient ruins, positioned far from the, or rather, positioned far from them, resembling sort of like what you'd expect Greek ruins to look like, maybe like the Acropolis. But the most amazing thing that they claimed to have seen were two strange, what they described as humanoid entities, without any visible diving suits or anything else to aid them in breathing underwater. Both these humanoids were about 2.5 meters tall. They had proportional hands, heads, legs, just like you would expect of a normal person, but they were just standing there. And again, at this depth, several dozen kilometers. Or no, I'm sorry, they weren't several dozen kilometers under the water, but they were southeast of Odessa at this location in the Black Sea. And so these humanoids were dressed in what they described as tight-fitting suits, but very different from terrestrial divers' suits, in that they were standing near some of these what appeared to be ruins that they had never seen before. One of them was moving some type of circular object that he held in his hand, which was moving. He was moving it in kind of a circular fashion over the ocean bottom, like he was scanning for something. More details weren't visible to the other witnesses, but the frightened divers then decided that they'd seen enough and hightailed it back to the surface. Well, allegedly, a fourth member of the team who had not been with the divers, they had remained on the shore, claimed that they had seen an amazing change occur in the sea. They said the Black Sea had been completely calm before, but then had suddenly swelled, and that strange greenish lights had appeared to have begun blinking from within the depths. They couldn't really tell what was going on. Had this been some sort of strange UFO activity? It reminds me of something that was released in the Russian Navy's UFO reports, released several years ago. And in those reports, the Russian Navy said that more than half of all, this is actually pretty well known, we've talked about this on the program before, more than half of all UFO encounters actually take place underwater. And one of the stories, and this one is truly creepy to me, again, you know, not all these encounters with not quite humans are always really creepy, but I think that what makes the idea alone a little unsettling is a person is pretty creepy. And I would argue that really, you can talk about monsters, aliens, cryptids, whatever. None of that stuff really, really, really bothers me. The creepiest thing probably that ever happened to me was I had been exploring some caves with a friend. And we went down, and I remember we'd been taking photos, and we'd found this weird little hole that went down into the ground. The hole was about the, you know, the same size around as the diameter of a basketball. We couldn't have fit into it, but we felt air coming up out of this hole, and so we thought it might connect with another series of caves somewhere underground. And so I remember she took her iPhone and snapped a picture down into that hole, and when we took the pictures and looked at them later, we saw what appeared to be a partially obscured face looking back at us. Now, of course, the face ended up being...
And then you asked Chris and I over, and then we were like,
yeah.
Really, dude?
I said, what do you think about this? And they're like, Micah, come on, that's you. And it was. It was just me. But from that angle, it definitely looked creepy. And the thought alone, when I had initially looked at the photograph, I didn't even want to look at it again. I looked at it. I thought, God, that looks like there's somebody down in that cave. She had been holding, you know, because the thing that about an iPhone is that there's a camera on both sides. Okay, one's like an 11-megapixel camera, and then the other's not so good. And if you have your camera set up the wrong way, you can snap a picture in one direction when you're holding the camera and meaning to take a picture in the opposite direction. That's what happened. She managed to capture a picture of my face partially obscured, blurred, and it looked, gave us the impression, of course, that there had been something down in the cave, and on closer inspection, indeed, yes, it, right down to the blemish on the cheek that was available on my sweaty skin, yes, it was me in the photograph. I never realized I could look so horrific. But the thing is that I don't think that it's so much that anything about the photo was so unsettling. It was the idea of one of two things. That A, there was something in that cave, in that little tiny hole, down in those dark, wet recesses, watching us when we were taking photographs. Or that there was someone down in that cave. And the things that will go through your mind when you are looking at a photograph of what appears to be someone in a cave... Again, I never thought I could be so scary. As much time as I spend in a cave, you know? Am I a Hadal? And that's what a Hadal is. These, you know, this reference to these humanoids that live underground. But there are stories. God, I don't like to think about them, but there are stories. If you dig around, you know, my mom always used to say when I was a kid, if you look for trouble, you'll find it. And you go looking for stories of weird humanoids, not quite humans, that crawl around in caves. They're out there. I couldn't tell you if they're true or not, but there are those kinds of stories. Red Pill Junkie in the chat room just said, Nega Micah. Yes, it was my negative side. Well, but in truth, all photographic anomalies and pranks aside, the point I'm trying to drive home here is the idea of there being these weird encounters in the least likely places with things that are not quite human. And I remember this story from the Russian Navy that they released where they had been in Lake Baikal, one of the largest freshwater lakes. I think it is actually the largest freshwater lake in Russia. And so the Russian Navy holds a lot of its diving training exercises there at Lake Baikal, but there are a lot of anomalous stories about things that go on in the depths of that large lake. For instance, they refer to seeing lights, the sounds of mechanical drones, like there's some sort of a mechanical operation or activity going on underwater. All sorts of things like this are reported there around Lake Baikal. And one of the stories that the Russian Navy had reported was that they had been leading a diving exercise at a pretty significant depth under Lake Baikal. And the divers in question, several of them spotted at a slightly greater depth than where they had been at the time. They spotted what appeared to be six small humanoids. And just like this story that I just read from the Black Sea in the Ukraine, the story went that these humanoids, there were six of them, they were very small, that they seemed to be wearing little silver suits, but that none of them appeared to be wearing any kind of diving apparatus. Now, the divers were obviously a little startled by this because they thought, who could be down here? Why would they be at that depth? And where are their diving suits? Where are their oxygen masks and where are their oxygen tanks? And so the story goes that a couple of the divers had tried to dive just deep enough to try and pursue these entities to find out who or what they were. The report doesn't state how some of the divers ended up dying, but it tells that a number of the divers that had been involved in that training operation that day did not make it back to the surface alive. Who knows what happened under the waters of Lake Baikal that day? But somewhere deep down in my own gut, it tells me that there was something not quite human going on there. So who really knows what's going on? And I thought that that would be a wonderful topic to bring up for Croctober, because I'm telling you, there's a lot of strange stuff out there. And I'm always talking about how, personally, what I find more interesting about the strange and unusual is what we might call, you know, the subtle little things, the subtle little mysteries, you know, the little stuff. I don't think that you have to have a Bigfoot or a Loch Ness Monster to find, you know, proof of or vindication that there is more to this reality than what we see every day. But every now and then, those full-on stories of encounters with beings, entities, non-humans, if you will. Whatever the hell these things may or may not be. It's a little unsettling sometimes, some of these stories, especially when you hear about people who go chasing these things and then never make it back. Chris, if you'd been down there, would you have gone after them?
Yes, but that's only because I'm confrontational.
Of course you would have. You'd have screamed, Hulk smash! And and taken off. So I hear
probably
you,
something a lot along those lines, yeah.
I hear that you've made the Milkman Chris Hayes image your Facebook picture.
I absolutely have, yes. It's a wonderful rendition of me. It captures my my decomposing tumescence quite wonderfully.
Your red eyes, your growl,
snarl. I want to make clear to anyone who's listening, who is my Facebook friend, while it's not visibly apparent, I believe that rendition of me actually has me whispering. I'm whispering in that
you're
picture.
Whispering in the picture.
So, Chris, you would chase after these things?
Well, of course.
I say that's pretty big talk for a guy with only one you know, health insurance policy or whatever. No.
I believe what you're trying
to
do is...
That's bold talk for a one-eyed fat man.
I believe what you're trying to do is disclose some personal information about me on the air, which I am more than willing to do so, but due to regulations...
Well, I have something...
It's not obscene, it's just... something we could get kicked off the air for.
Well, I have something that I think is far more interesting, frankly, because whether or not you would go chasing after deep water humanoids, half humans, whatever.
There was, sorry to interrupt, there was also a story that Lulu put in the chat room about someone called the Sylvan Park Slasher, I believe, and if I pronounce that wrong, I'm sorry. I don't feel like scrolling all the way down to the bottom of my window because it's far away. But
he's such a hard worker.
I know, right?
Apparently, there's this guy in the Nashville area where if you go to some local rail yard, goodness, I can't talk tonight, and imbibe in some illicit substances, some guy will pop out of the dark screaming and chase you around with a knife. I really wanted... I asked if anyone had stood their ground, and she said someone had, but I want to stand my ground and punch him in the face.
That sounds like one for your Urban Legends book.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. It's like, we need to take a trip right now.
But no, this isn't like an urban legend. This happens currently.
Oh, well, that's not cool.
Well, that's... Yeah.
Nobody would.
Well, maybe now I'm scared.
Have you ever heard this urban legend, the story of Scissors Girl? Do you know that one? I think it's a Japanese urban legend about a girl who, if I remember the story correctly, it was something along the lines of a girl who she has what. I'm scraping my memory here to try and recall exactly what happened here, but the story I think was that she had what is known as a Glasgow smile. You know, she had a widened smile because the sides of her cheeks.
A Chelsea smile.
Yeah, her cheeks had been slit like that. And she is some sort of an apparition that will appear before someone. And then she asks, do you think I'm beautiful? And if you say apparently yes or no, she'll just stab you.
Are you talking
to
about the Japanese thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. No, if you say yes, the whole thing is if you say yes, she will, I believe it's slice you up and be like, "Oh, you think it's beautiful now?" And if you say no, she'll get really offended and kill you. But you have to give a non-committal answer for her to be stumped. And
typical.
While she's stumped, you have to haul bottom away from her as fast as you can.
But I think she'll still kill you.
So she says,
"Yeah." I mean, eventually you're gonna get killed by some crazy lady with scissors, but.
I tell you, every time I hear that one, though, I always think about that, like, hellishly creepy thing. That
weird comic strip?
Yes.
I think Micah actually showed it to us.
Oh, yeah.
That was, as you scroll down, certain panels would animate and freak you the crap.
Yeah, there was a cartoon rendition, I think, of... I don't know if that... No, that one was not the Scissors Girl. That was a slightly different one.
It was some Korean...
The story was it was a girl that was walking along...
Looking for her child or something. Yeah. She committed suicide.
God. She jumped off of
it. The first time I saw it, it scared the bejesus out of me.
Oh, like, yeah.
Because I was alone at my parents' house. I was house-sitting for them. They were in Mississippi. I had just probably drank 3.5 bottles of wine. I was like, "Oh, what's this for Micah? Oh, God!" It was pretty terrible.
Hey, guys, look at this.
And then I commenced to showing everybody.
See, the bad part is that I watched it here in the studio with everyone and was like, "Yeah, that was creepy. I really didn't have a big reaction."
And then you went home.
No, and then I drive home, and I get out, and it's like, pitch black everywhere. I'm walking
some
down my driveway. I'm like,
down your street.
And I'm like,
"You see my
good
child.
Lord, now it's behind me now that I've seen it."
It's like when we watched the new rendition of Crazies at my old house after that movie. Like it, and it was far more scary than it should have been. But we, after the movie, I walked Matt out to his car and I just swore I could hear the scraping of that pitchfork across my driveway. And ugh. Wow, I ran in my house.
That's just, yeah, exactly. And I tell you, you know, that's the thing is that I think that we all like to be scared. If we didn't, we wouldn't be talking about these sorts of things. You know, those, not quite human, slightly disfigured and monstrous and evil and lives underwater and has bat wings. Those kinds of things. I just got to tell you, you know, I think that's a good subject to kick off our Croctober celebration here on the Graylian Report with. And if you are the meek of heart and you don't like getting scared, you may have to give this podcast a miss for the next few weeks. We're going to be delving into the Dybbuk box. We're going to be talking about real ghosts and hauntings. You'll hear more about our unraveling of the mysteries at Reynolds Mansion and so much more in the weeks to come here on the Graylian Report. My friends, as always, I'm Micah Hanks and the Graylian Gang. Until next time, stay strange. We'll talk to you soon.